Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome. For the last two in this series of Wreath Lectures, we've come to the Middle East. Daniel Barenboim had intended to deliver this, the fourth lecture, in the Palestinian city of Ramallah. But because of the growing tensions in the West Bank, we've been advised not to go there. So both lectures will be delivered here in Jerusalem, but in different parts of the city. Today we're just outside the walls of the Old City, in an area mainly inhabited by Palestinians, who make up the bulk of our audience. Barenboim is a controversial figure in this part of the world. A Jew whose family made their home in Israel when he was 10 years old, he believes that the destinies of Israelis and Palestinians are, as he puts it, inextricably linked. And he's tried to exemplify this through that which he knows best, music. In 1999, he joined with the late Palestinian intellectual Edward Said to create an orchestra made up of young Israeli and Arab musicians, called the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. It's the living representation of its founder's central belief that music has the power to bring people together. To explain why and how, please would you welcome the Wreath Lecturer 2006, Daniel Barenboim.
Thank you very much. Edward Said said that music is a little bit subversive. That too, of course, speaks about how we perceive it and not about the music itself. But he was unquestionably right. In music, different notes and voices meet, link to each other, either in joint expression or in counterpoint, which means exactly that, counterpoint or another point. And yet the two fit together. Please allow me to give you some very simple, simplistic, I would say, examples of what I mean. The slow movement of Beethoven's Pathetic Sonata, which I'm sure many of you have heard many times and some of you probably even played, is a relatively simple melody. Etc. When we examine it a little bit more closely, we see that obviously there is a main voice that sings its way through the whole passage. And the bass accompanies it in the best sense of the word, not in a situation where the bass is only following, but having its own to say, and goes up when the melody goes down and opposite. Thereby influencing each other. And there is still the middle voice that gives a sense of continuity, of fluidity. This is a relatively simple example. I can give you one more, perhaps, which might be of use for us later, and that is the last prelude of the first book of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier. There, the main voice is less obvious, because it could be that, or it could be with all sorts of possibilities. But you see in all that, that in music there is a hierarchy, if you want, with equality. And that is what, of course, is much easier than in life. How difficult it is to achieve equality and yet to find the hierarchy. In times of totalitarian or autocratic rule, music, indeed culture in general, is often the only avenue of independent thought. It is the only way people can meet as equals and exchange ideas. Culture then becomes primarily the voice of the oppressed, and it takes over from politics as a driving force for change. Think of how often in societies suffering from political oppression or from a vacuum in leadership, culture took a dynamic lead. We have many extraordinary examples of this phenomenon. Samizdat writings in the former Eastern Bloc, South African poetry and drama under apartheid, and of course, Palestinian literature amidst so much conflict. Need only mention one important Palestinian poet, Mahmoud Darwish, and many others. Culture brings contact between people, or shall we say, culture can bring contact between people, it can bring people closer together, and it can encourage understanding. This is why Edward Said and I started the West Eastern Divan Project as a way to bring together musicians from the different Arab countries and from Israel to work together, to make music together, and ultimately, when we realized how much interest there was, to form an orchestra. When we had the first idea, which was linked to the city of Weimar in Germany being cultural capital of Europe in 1999, we expected to have a small forum of maybe 8 or 12 young people who would come and make music together and spend a week or 10 days as a workshop with us. So you can imagine the surprise we had when there were over 200 applicants from the Arab world alone. And this is how this orchestra was formed. Edward and I met by chance in London in 1993 in a hotel lobby. I'd gone to London to give a concert, and ironically, he was there to give the 1993 Rees Lectures, which explored the changing role of the intellectual in today's world. Now, 13 years later, I have brought the Rees Lectures here to the Middle East. We took the name of our project, the West Eastern Divan, from a poem by Goethe, who was one of the first Germans to be genuinely interested in other cultures. He originally discovered Islam when a German soldier who had been fighting in one of the Spanish campaigns brought back a page of the Quran to show to him. His enthusiasm was so great that he started to learn Arabic at the age of 60. Later, he discovered the great Persian poet Hafiz, and that was the inspiration for his set of poems that deal with the idea of the other, the West Eastern Divan, which was first published nearly 200 years ago in 1819, at the same time, interestingly enough, that Beethoven was working on his Ninth Symphony, his celebrated testament to fraternity. Goethe's poem then became a symbol for the idea behind our experiment in bringing Arab and Israeli musicians together. This orchestra consists of Arab musicians from Palestine, from the territories, and Palestinians from Israel, Syrians, Lebanese, Jordanians, and Egyptian, and of course Israeli musicians. Now, when you play music, whether you play chamber music or you play in an orchestra, you have to do two very important things and do them simultaneously. You have to be able to express yourself, otherwise you are not contributing to the musical experience. But at the same time, it is imperative that you listen to the other. You have to understand what the other is doing. And the other may be doing the same as you, if he is sitting next to you, if you are a string player, or he may play a different instrument and be in counterpoint to what you are doing. But in all cases, it is impossible to play intelligently in an orchestra, concentrating only on one of those two things. If you concentrate only on what you do, you might play very well, but might play so loud that you cover the others, or so soft that you are not heard. And of course, you cannot play only by listening, but the art of playing music is the art of simultaneous playing and listening. In other words, one enhances the other. And this is the main reason we started this workshop. Edward once said, "Separation between people is not a solution for any of the problems that divide people. And certainly, ignorance of the other provides no help whatever." In this workshop, we were trying to start a dialogue, to take a single step forward, and to find common ground. And we saw what happened when an Arab musician shared a music stand with an Israeli musician, both trying to play the same note with the same dynamic, with the same stroke of the bow, if they were string players, with the same sound, with the same expression. They were trying to do something together about which they were both passionate, because after all, you cannot be an indifferent musician. Music demands permanently, at all times, passion and effort. The idea, in a sense, was as simple as that, because once you have agreed on how to play one note together, you can no longer look at each other the same way again. That was our starting point. And from the beginning, Edward and I were filled with optimism, despite the darkening sky, as he called it, with what has turned out sadly to be all too accurate foresight. In the West Eastern Divan, the universal metaphysical language of music becomes the link. It is the language of the continuous dialogue that these young people have with each other. Music is their common framework, their abstract language of harmony. As I've said before in these lectures, nothing in music is independent. It requires the perfect balance between head, heart, and stomach. And I would argue that when emotion and intellect are in tune, it is easier also for human beings and for nations to look outward as well as inward. And therefore, through music, we can see an alternative social model, a kind of practical utopia from which we might learn about expressing ourselves freely and hearing one another. This and many other things you can really learn from playing music, so long as you don't view music only as a pastime, no matter how enjoyable, or as something to forget the world, but something from which you can actually understand the way the world can, should, and sometimes does function. In any case, from the beginning, it was our belief, Edward's and mine, that the destinies of our two people, the Palestinian people and the Israeli people, are inextricably linked, and therefore the welfare, the sense of justice, and the happiness of one has to eventually, inevitably, be that of the other, which is certainly not the case today. Of course, the West Eastern Divan Orchestra is not going to bring about peace. What it can do, however, is to bring understanding. It can awaken the curiosity and then perhaps the courage to listen to the narrative of the other and at the very least accept its legitimacy. This, if you want, is the main idea behind this project. And people very often ask me, but this is a wonderful example of tolerance. And I say, no, I don't like the word tolerance, because to tolerate something or somebody means you tolerate them for negative reasons. You tolerate somebody in spite of the fact that he or she is ugly. You tolerate somebody in spite of the fact that he or she is stupid. And therefore, tolerance is used, and I would say misused in today's world and in the press very often, is a very misleading word. The French Revolution gave us three much more important and powerful ideas or concepts: liberty, equality, and fraternity. But these ideas of the French Revolution are not only right in themselves, but they are so because they come in the proper order. You cannot have equality without liberty, and you certainly cannot have fraternity without equality. The importance of this I learned from music, because music evolves in time, and therefore the order inevitably determines the content. And I have never had to ask myself the question, can't we have equality before liberty? And this underlines, if you want, a central problem of our conflict here in the Middle East. When young musicians from the opposite camps, as it were, come together, they have the liberty. They have the liberty or choice whether to come or not to play music together. They also, however, have something just as important, and that is automatically they have equality, because music gives everyone the same possibilities, regardless of race, sex, religion, or where they come from. In front of a Beethoven symphony, we are all equals. And although the fraternity does not have to be there, it is at least a possibility, whereas now, in real life, it is not. I know, or rather, I feel, no. I feel, I suspect, and I know that some of you might think the idea of Palestinians and other Arabs and Israelis playing together is unacceptable. I know that this is unacceptable for many of my friends in Ramallah, for instance. And I understand it, because it is seen as a form of normalization. And by that I mean an acceptance of the status quo. And this is unacceptable to them because the real problems of actual existence have not been solved. And when we played in Ramallah last August, there were people who said, how can we look at Israelis, Palestinians and other Arabs playing together when the Israeli tanks are here and when we have the situation that we have now? But as Edward Said said, I quote, my friend Daniel Barenboim and I have chosen this course for humanistic rather than political reasons, on the assumption that ignorance is not a strategy for sustainable survival. When Palestinians and other Arabs meet Israelis in music, the primary quality that is missing in the political life, namely the equality, is already a given. Therefore, this may be precisely the starting point for them to show each other that what they have in music, the equality and the ability to converse with each other on equal footing, will lead them to look for ways to find that outside of music. Music, in this case, is not an expression of what life is, but an expression of what life could be or what it could become. Music itself should not be used for political or any other purposes. But although you cannot make music through politics, perhaps you can give political thinking an example through music. As the great conductor Sergiu Celibidache said, music does not become something, but something may become music. Thank you very much.
Daniel Van Boom, thank you very much indeed. So music is a great equalizer, but only if the players are willing to listen to each other. Here in the Middle East, where the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is as tense as ever, is it possible that this metaphor of music can describe a way forward? Let me remind listeners that our audience this evening is a predominantly Arab one. We're in a part of Jerusalem inhabited mainly by Palestinians. Next week, in another part of the city, we'll have a predominantly Jewish Israeli audience. So, to our questions, and the first is from Razan Kaloti, who works for the Office of the British Council, which is responsible for the Palestinian territories. Razan, your question, please.
As a Palestinian and having to live under extremely harsh living conditions and daily humiliation, my question would be, how would music really help?
Well, maybe you should go to Ramallah day after tomorrow. In Ramallah day after tomorrow, in the Palace of Culture, there is a concert by an all-Palestinian orchestra. Half or more or less, half from Ramallah and the other half from Nazareth. Now, since you're Palestinian and you live in the area, you know that what I have said is practically an impossibility. How do you get 20 or 25 youngsters from Nazareth to go through the checkpoints and to get the permissions and to go to Ramallah to join other children who have the same passion and the same will to play together? This is not going to solve the problems, it's not going to solve the inner Palestinian problems, but it can do several other things. First of all, I think it should be a day of great joys and pride to all Palestinians to see 40 or 45 youngsters, as I said, from Ramallah and from Nazareth, walking on stage to produce something which is not even something that one associates with Palestinian culture. Classical Western music is not exactly the quality that first comes to mind. And yet you have children and very young people, most of them under 16, some of them 10 and 11, who have, through the passion and the curiosity, found something that will give them a sense of pride, as I said, of dignity. All those things which Palestinians so rightly complain the lack of in their society.
Reza, are you in any way convinced by that? You sounded skeptical when you began. You're saying that the realities of everyday life make it quite difficult.
It's much different than, it's, as they say, it's easier said than...
than done. Easier exactly. Said than done.
The salaries are not paid. Extremely hard living conditions. Even having to go to Ramallah to do some work, we have to cross checkpoints, humiliation. So it's not that easy.
No, I know. I never claimed it was easy, and I didn't claim that it is a substitute for that. I'm just saying that we have to find ways that each and every human being in life has achieved something that he doesn't want to lose.
Is this on this subject of music being the equalizer is very difficult when you're confronted with the harsh reality of everyday life in the occupied territories?
My name is George Sahar. I am from CARE International. What I hear you, Mr. Birenbaum, saying is that it doesn't necessarily have to be that the guns have to be silent so that we can hear the music. And I feel that this is interesting, but it's an added challenge for us as Palestinians, because we still are in a stage where we have to prove our humanity to the world. And music is supposed to be an equalizer. So I really like to hear your perspective about it. Can we hear the music when the guns are still so loud? Thank you very much.
Well, I think, you are perfectly right. There is an area where the music and the reality does not always go hand in hand. And I don't believe that music is an equalizer. Music is nothing except itself. What you can do is find the equality in the music. It will not silence the guns, and it will not do any of those things. And let me tell you something else in a very, in a very constructive and positive way. I wish many Israelis could go to Ramallah on Saturday to hear this all-Palestinian orchestra. Believe me, the Jewish people have played a major role in classical music over the last 200 or 300 years. Some of the best musicians all over the world were that. And with what respect they would suddenly look at these Palestinians who are able to play this music in a way that is not only as good as some of the Israeli children, in some cases, maybe even better. When I was a child, I came to Vienna from Argentina. I was 10 years old. It was in 1952. And Vienna was occupied by the four powers: the Soviet Union, the United States, Great Britain, and France. And the Americans brought Coca-Cola. And the whole of Vienna went on a Coca-Cola feast. They had never seen anything like that. And a week or 10 days later, the Vienna Philharmonic played a concert with the great Soviet violinist David Oistrakh. And believe me, that day, the Soviets conquered a place in the heart of all the Viennese, and not just the musicians, because of that. And I am sure you are such a talented people, and I'm not saying this to flatter you. I know this. For many years, I've been working with a lot of your people. You have such a fantastic strength and force of talent that everything has to be done to allow all Palestinians to develop and express themselves in that. This is why I'm involved in all of this.
I'm going to take one more point on this, and then I'm going to move on.
My name is Shirley Benjamin, and I'm a Jewish Israeli. And from my point of view, the terrible problem is to get the Israeli Jews to open their eyes to what's going on. I'm on the internet every day, and I have friends, and I know what's going on. Can you not bring this orchestra to Israel, to the Jewish part of the country, to let Jews see that they're not everything that we see on the television?
When Edward Said and I started this orchestra, and we saw what it can do and how it traveled, we realized that the full dimension of the project will only happen when this orchestra is allowed to play in all the countries that are represented in it: Israel, Palestine, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, etc. We are not there yet. We've made the conscious decision to go to Ramallah last year because we thought this is the most obvious and clear humanistic attitude. It was not a political attitude. Had we tried to go to Damascus or to Tel Aviv, this would have been a very, very clear political thing, which we didn't really want to do that. But I am sure that the day will come when we will play both in Tel Aviv and in Damascus. We are not quite there, but we will get there.
I'm going to come to a question here on the front row now from Tova Lasarov, who describes herself as an American Israeli. That's right, isn't it? And she's a journalist with the Jerusalem Post.
I had a couple questions, actually.
No. Give us one question.
She's bossy with me, too. Don't worry. It's not personal.
Yeah, you can't ask a couple of questions. Ask a question, and if it's good, and if the answer rolls, then we'll let you ask another one. But
okay.
Don't push
it up. I'll start with this one, then. Can you think of a specific example where music in this area has actually changed the political process?
No, because neither the political leadership of Israel, nor from what I know, the Palestinian is musical enough.
Go on, you can ask another one then. Well,
Now ask the other question, maybe it's better.
I'm going to continue that. I mean, is it people that you're trying to change here or the politicians?
You mean politicians are not people? I'm sorry, you know. I'm not trying to change anyone. I'm trying to work in an area which, to me personally, is very important, and that is the understanding of the narrative of the other. And I think that we can do that in our small utopian republic, which has existed since 1999, where everybody's life has been, to some extent, changed by these experiences. This is what gives music making a quality that is lacking in so much of the music making today in the whole world, and that is its existential quality. We have now wonderful specialists on the violin, on the oboe, on the piano, whatever they are, really specialized workers that can do all sorts of acrobatics and things on the instrument. But this is not what we are talking about. We are talking of the expression in music as being something existential, which is more than pain or pleasure. It is pain and pleasure. And this is what this orchestra does.
But I think that is the point. I think that is what people feel sometimes, Daniel, about this, that you are, and one understands why you're insistent, that it's not any kind of political thing that you have set up here with the West Eastern Divan. But nevertheless, if you are setting up a utopia that you hope is some kind of metaphor for how life could be led, how there could be some kind of equalization and some kind of harmony, you cannot say it is not political, whether you like stepping into that area or not.
But then you have to really, I'm sorry, but then you have to really define very clearly and very specifically what is political. Is political tactics or is political strategy? If political is strategy, then I take what you say about our project as a compliment. If you think political is tactical, then I will continue saying it is not that.
My name is Mamdouh Haker. I am a physician, a Palestinian physician and surgeon. I'm very glad, Daniel, that you mentioned Mahmoud Darwish in your lecture. Just last week, Mahmoud Darwish and I were talking about the harsh reality we are facing as Palestinians. Maybe I need just to mention to you that to be here, it took me honestly 2 hours to get from Ramallah to here, in spite of having all the necessary credentials. But what actually Mahmoud Darwish was saying is that now, within all this reality, focusing on culture is our chance to keep floating. This is exactly what he said, to keep floating in this world. Can music go to the open air and be a cry for justice and freedom, liberty, equality and fraternity, as you mentioned? Why not to perform in the open air in front of the wall, not to make a political statement, but at least to show the ugliness of the situation? Can this happen?
Why not?
Please.
Well, I mean, I rather wish there were no wall and this would not be necessary. But since the wall is here, why not?
Yes,
so you have noticed, I'm sure, that I have refrained from voicing too much criticism, if you want, on the Israeli side today here. And if I've done so, it is only because it would be very easy success for me here. I'd rather do that in Israel proper. I have never spoken a critical word about Israel in Ramallah, and I have no intention of doing it here today. Not because I have nothing to criticize. I have been very vocal about this on many occasions all over the world. But allow me just only one sentence. One of the most important things, in my view, is it is imperative that a situation is brought about where the legitimacy of the Palestinian narration is accepted by Israel, its politicians, and all its citizens. This has to be the first step. Until that moment has come, nothing will be real. And this is exceptionally important.
I'm going to call in Ari Shevitt, who's an Israeli and a senior columnist on Haaretz, a leading national newspaper here.
Mr. Birnbaum, I think that it's obvious that your project, the project you launched with Professor Said, is a benign project. I don't see any way one can contest the idea of an orchestra of the others learning to play together and to be in dialogue one with another. But what I would like to question is the metaphor there. You have come with the BBC team to the land of tragedy. The tragedy being that there are two people here who have lost their own music. Don't you think that in order to move forward, in order to have a civilized, peaceful life here, each people needs a time with his own music? Don't you think that if you try to put two peoples into one position where they are challenged with the music of the other in an intimate situation, that endangers the very project you want to advance?
I think it's a very legitimate question, although based, if I may say so, on an erroneous understanding of the problem. This is not Israeli music versus Arab music. We're not talking here about Jewish music. We're not talking about klezmer music against the music of Beirut. Beethoven was German, yes, but he was much more than that. He was everything. This is something that we all draw from. It is not the privilege of the Israelis to say we are classical musicians, and therefore they are not forcing the Palestinians to accept something of their own.
No, I want to emphasize that the project itself I find inspiring in every way. I just think that we all should think about whether we want to take the metaphor seriously and to translate it to a political goal, or where do we reach the more realistic idea, which says that each people needs some time with itself to assert its own identity. And I think you've heard it in the questions here among the Palestinians, many of the Palestinians who somewhat feel threatened by what they see as a cultural invasion of Israelis into their own terrain,
I'm sorry to disagree with you. I haven't felt that at all. I have felt some questioning and criticism of many other things, but I haven't felt that at all. And I think that anything that makes every single Israeli have to think for a moment that there is a legitimacy in the point of view of the other, even if they are uncomfortable for the Israelis. And I've never shied away from that, and I don't really believe in that. And if anybody has the fear that this is another form of Israeli invasion, if you want, I can only tell you that this is a total misunderstanding of the nature of music and where it comes from.
I'm going to call, finally, Raja Shahada, who's a human rights lawyer and writer based in Ramallah, which is where he was born. He was called to the bar in London and then returned to private practice in Ramallah. He's been there ever since.
I'm very concerned about the destruction of the landscape, which I find to be irreversible. The rolling hills of the West Bank and the deep valleys are like music captured in stone. Their beauty and the lives of the Palestinians who inhabit them are being destroyed by the discordant wall, which is so out of sync with the nature of the land. My question is, can music made by people from the different sides of the wall restore the harmony before it is lost forever?
We come back to the same point again every time, Daniel.
Raja, you make it very difficult for me. You make it very difficult for me. I still believe that anything that people can share together, whether it is through music or through ideas or through friendship or whatever it is, cannot be negative. It cannot do damage. And what I wish for a much greater percentage of Israelis to really concentrate and understand this part of Palestinian history. That's what I said earlier, that until Israelis accept the legitimacy of the Palestinian narration, nothing will move, not only in a way that you Palestinians want, but in a way that is humanly just.
Quick last question.
I absolutely believe that this is true. I've heard the Divan Orchestra on several occasions, and what struck me is not only that it's possible to have people from both sides play together, but the fact that when they play together, they can create something which is more beautiful than what either alone can.
They enhance each other.
Yeah. And I think that's a very important message, because I think the Israeli experience and ideology is that we must have Jews only in Israel. So there were always Jews living in Arab countries, and now they don't. And that this is a better situation, that the Arabs live on one side, the Jews live on the other side. And this possibility of hybridity is lost. And I think the Divan is showing that if it is restored, it will be better for everybody.
Thank you.
Music to your ears, as they say. That's it. Thank you very much. Next week, Daniel Barenboim ends his series with a lecture about the difference between power and strength. Music, like politicians, can have both. The art is knowing how to combine them. That's Barenboim in Jerusalem on music and political leadership at the same time next week. For now, our thanks to Daniel Barenboim and goodbye.
Sue Lawley introduced the Reef Lectures delivered by Daniel Barenboim. The producer was Tony Phillips and the editor.